On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a big, bloody week in the news, and Newt Gingrich is all about seeing things in big terms, bloody if necessary. Gingrich looks at the Mideast this week and sees the very survival of Israel at stake. He looks more broadly around the planet and says he sees World War III breaking out. From the Mideast, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea abroad, to stem cells, culture war, and immigration at home, the former Speaker of the House and architect of the 1990s Republican Revolution says the United States is at a crossroads akin to April 1861 and the start of the Civil War. What's he going to do about it? Well, maybe run for president. Joining me now from Washington is Newt Gingrich. He was architect of the contract with America that helped lead the Republican Party in 1994 to victory and reclaim the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. He served as Speaker of the House until 1998. His book, Winning the Future, A 21st Century Contract with America, has been updated and newly released in paperback. The wise guys all say he's running for president in 08. Newt Gingrich, welcome to On Point.
It's good to be with you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Speaker.
Newt Gingrich, World War III, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that if you try to understand each incident of violence by itself, you can't possibly appreciate what's happening. If you go from North Korea, where there were seven missiles launched deliberately on the 4th of July, And by the way, we now know, based on testimony yesterday by the State Department, that there were Iranians at the missile launching. Then you go to Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia, and Thailand, where there are terrorist groups. Then you go to Mumbai, India, where last month seven bombs went off, killing over 200 people. Then you go to Afghanistan, where there's a war underway with the sanctuary in Pakistan, without which the Taliban would not survive. And then you go to the Iranian, Syrian, Hezbollah, Hamas terrorist alliance, which has an impact both in the Iraqi war, where they're killing innocent Iraqis and Americans and British, and also the war from South Lebanon and Gaza against Israel. Then you go to Somalia, where the forces of terrorism have gained control of most of the country and begin to potentially could create a new Afghanistan under the Taliban kind of situation. You go to Europe, where the British Home Secretary has said there are in Britain 1,200 terrorists in some 20 terror organizations. You go to Canada, where 18 Canadians were arrested for terrorism, including having twice as much explosive power as was used in Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and with a plan to capture the prime minister and behead him. And finally, you come to America, where seven people in Miami last week were videotaped pledging allegiance to Al-Qaeda to overthrow the U.S. government, and where we have been told there's a plot in three different countries to come together and try to destroy tunnels in New York City. I might mention in passing that Hezbollah has, for 25 years, had a presence in Paraguay and South America. Just take those patterns right there. Add to it the fact that Tehran unveiled a month ago a statue of Simón Bolívar as a sign of their unity with Cesar Chavez in Venezuela, and that Chavez is both now buying Russian fighter planes and is off on a trip to Iran to indicate the solidarity he feels with the people who finance Hezbollah and Hamas. When you look at all of that, it is worldwide, and it is a genuine war, and we have enemies. This is not a war we're picking. We have enemies who wish to destroy us and who say so quite publicly.
So a lot of trouble, and trouble on many fronts. A world war framing kind of suggests there's a unified field behind it. Do you see that? And is when you frame it as war, does that mean that war, military response, is the only response? And what does Iraq say to the efficacy of that?
Well, I think, first of all, Iraq says exactly what Guadalcanal said, exactly what Antietam in the campaign to Richmond said, and that is these things are very hard. It was not easy to win the Second World War. It was not easy to win the Civil War. I think that this is a very hard fight. It's going to be, a very tough fight. I'm not offering any simple, easy solutions. Look what's happening to the Israelis. They withdraw from South Lebanon, and 6 years later, Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah have put 13,000 missiles into the exact territory that the Israelis withdrew from and are now killing Israeli civilians with missiles being fired. They withdraw from Gaza, and a year later, Hamas is killing Israelis from exactly the territory the Israelis withdrew from. I mean, the answer in Israel is quite simple. You either think Israel has a right to exist, or you think that all of the Jews should leave. Hezbollah says not a single inch of Israeli territory will remain. The leader of Hamas said not a single Jew will remain. You don't negotiate with people like that. You don't have ceasefires with people like that. Either you win or they win, but it's a straight-up fight for survival.
Newt Gingrich, let's listen for just a moment if we made a Kofi Annan and President Bush on this subject. First, Annan.
While Hezbollah's actions are deplorable, and as I've said, Israel has a right to defend itself, the excessive use of force is to be condemned.
Excessive use of force to be condemned. Of course, he wants a ceasefire. President Bush says...
Everybody abhors the loss of innocent life. On the other hand, what we recognize is that the root cause of the problem is Hezbollah. And that problem must be addressed.
Newt Gingrich, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, now said perhaps likely to be in that region as early as Sunday. What should the U.S. do? Do you approve of the kind of, you know, hanging back, giving Israel the green light that we've seen so far? And what should the future path be here in your view?
Well, let me just start and say you had a quote from Condoleezza Rice at the beginning of the show where she said, we all want peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. There was a two-part series in The New Yorker in 2002 that said Hezbollah wants to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth.
To be generous to her, I kind of imagine she was thinking of the we in terms of allies, but you say if you pull it right across the scene, it ain't so.
But my point is if the person on the other side of the table wants to kill you, there's not much to negotiate. Ahmadinejad, the dictator of Iran, says, I want to defeat the Americans. He says Anglo-Saxon, so he includes the British. And I want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. Now, this is a public speech to a large crowd on television.
The Bush administration has gone to war in Iraq and given Israel a green light to really pound Lebanon. Do you think they're being too soft in this region?
I believe that the administration should reach out to the Lebanese government. And this is where I think Kofi Annan is, frankly, so reprehensibly one-sided in favor of the terrorists. The UN has done nothing for 6 years while Hezbollah, Syria and Iran put 13,000 missiles into Lebanese territory. The UN did nothing. Kofi Annan did nothing. And now that they are killing Israelis, Kofi Annan is shocked that the Israelis are actually defending themselves.
And what about the Bush White House? Is it hanging back too much in your view? Should it go on to Syria, on to Iran?
I think the Bush White House, or rather, the American government. I mean, I think the American government should reach out to the Lebanese government and say, you have two choices. You can work with us to replace Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and you will then control southern Lebanon. Or you can stay out of the fight, and the Israelis will destroy Hezbollah. But my view is that, and I think this is historically accurate, is if there is a single missile left in south Lebanon, if there is a single Iranian Revolutionary Guard in South Lebanon, and there are at least 400 there right now, then this is a defeat for civilization.
George Will saying this week that some of the neoconservative complaints about not being tough enough are delivering criticism so untethered from reality as to defy caricature. Is he talking about your camp, Mr. Gingrich?
I don't know. You have to ask George Will. I mean, I thought his column was strangely uprooted from what's actually happening in the region. We've had essentially a group of people who have for 59 years tried to destroy Israel. They're quite clear about it. And this is the place I want all of our listeners to stop and think about. If Hamas says not a single Jew will remain, if Hezbollah says not a single inch of Israeli territory will remain, if Ahmadinejad says, I want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth, how would you negotiate? How would you coexist with people like that, knowing that if we have a ceasefire tomorrow morning, it simply means that Hezbollah will be resupplied, that they will train even further, that the next generation of missiles will reach Tel Aviv instead of simply Haifa, that not a single inch of Israel will be safe, and that someday down the road they're going to try to get biological or chemical or nuclear weapons and kill people by the hundreds of thousands.
Let's hear another couple of voices on the Mideast blow up this week. First, Syria's ambassador to the U.S., Imad Mustafa, saying the U.S. must become engaged to resolve the conflict.
I think the United States should fulfill its role as the world's unique superpower and play once more the role it used to play before as a broker for peace.
And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice saying the Middle East needs lasting peace, not a hasty ceasefire.
The Middle East has been through too many spasms of violence, and we have to deal with underlying conditions so that we can create a sustainable conditions for political progress there.
Former Speaker Newt Gingrich is with us. His book, Winning the Future, A 21st Century Contract with America, is out now in updated paperback. Jack Beattie, let me turn to you. World War III?
I don't think so. It seems to me that if the American national interest could speak through President Bush, it would do this. He would call the Israeli prime minister and say, Mr. Prime Minister, I need a favor from you. In return, I'll do a very big favor for you. Halt your campaign in Lebanon. It is hurting our security. The Arabs know we pay for the bombs you're dropping on Lebanon. The scenes on Arab TV, 500,000 people out of 3.8 million made homeless. Hell, that's tantamount to over 30 million Americans, apartment buildings leveled, children dying. We can't have it. Before September 11th, what were our interests, Mr. Prime Minister? Oil and your survival. Those interests remain. But now we have an existential imperative to win Arab hearts and minds, to prevent the virus of bin Ladenism from spreading. So you call off the war. I'll say I urge that course on you for humanitarian reasons. You show anger at me to lend me a little moral capital in the Arab world. Then, the big favor to you, as soon as I stop talking, I'll call Assad and say, what do you want? An end to sanctions, trade, you name it. In return, you call off Hezbollah. I don't care how, kill their leaders, that's your style. Make them stop firing the rockets today. Then I'll call that madman in Iran and offer him this deal. Break with Hezbollah. Let in the stand down your nuclear activity, and we'll give you a security guarantee. No regime change. We'll recognize you. Trade the works, but you make them stand down, and you begin to talk about recognizing Israel. A grand bargain, Mr. Prime Minister, that would accomplish Israel's objectives, isolating Hezbollah from its suppliers, ending the rockets while strengthening the U.S. position. And by the way, helping us in Iraq where we need Iran's help.
Newt Gingrich, I can imagine your wheels turning on that. A grand bargain, call Israel off. What do you say?
You know, as a history teacher, I am always amazed at the degree to which hope springs eternal with no reference to the historic record. In the year 2000, Bill Clinton invited Arafat and Barack to come and sit down and talk. And Barack offered Arafat everything he had asked for. And Arafat turned him down because he couldn't afford to accept it, because it would mean Israel would survive. The notion that we have been talking, for example, to the North Koreans for over a dozen years, that Clinton's Secretary of State danced with Kim Jong-il, one of the most despicable moments in modern American history, since he is a vicious dictator with 300,000 people in concentration camps. And the North Koreans lied to us. The fact is that we learned 3 years ago, because dissident groups brought the information out, that the Iranians had been lying to the International Atomic Energy Agency for 18 years. The Iranians said last year to the Europeans, you will either give us permission to build nuclear weapons, or we will build nuclear weapons without your permission. The North Koreans were censured by a mild resolution the strongest China and Russia would permit last week, and within 45 minutes had walked out of the Security Council, rejected the resolution, and said they frankly didn't care what the UN thought.
So what's your end game, Newt Gingrich? You said we should blow up the missiles on the launch pad. Is it bring it all to war? And is that a winner, ultimately?
Wait a second. Mm-hmm. I'm just starting with this idea that this fantasy that we could have some deal with Assad. I gave a speech at the American Enterprise Institute 3 years ago and said, the State Department consistently revisits how to cut a deal with Syria, and Syria consistently spits in our eye. The Iranians are very clear about this. They say it as publicly as they know how. They want to defeat us. They want to have nuclear. They don't want a guarantee from us. They want to have a nuclear weapon. They want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. They want to dominate the Persian Gulf. I commend everybody, Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down. Mm. has just written a new book called Guests of the Ayatollah,
mm-hmm.
in which which is a study of the first great Iranian breaking of international law when they seized the American embassy and held diplomats hostage in total violation. I mean, even in the Second World War, the Nazis repatriated our diplomats, we repatriated theirs. This was total violation of all modern law.
We know it, and there's the history, but what's your endgame
here? Let me make my point.
Yes?
The subtitle of Bowden's book is Iran's First Attack, the First Attack in Iran's War on America. Now, I think any notion that Iran, which is the primary funder of Hezbollah, which has had over 400 Iranian Revolutionary Guards in South Lebanon since 1983, which has given 13,000 missiles to Hezbollah, the idea that Iran is going to turn on Hezbollah is a stunning disregard of reality. I mean, you can argue we ought to eliminate Israel. You know, we could offer sanctuary to 6 million Jews. We could let them all leave. We could give up until the next time there's a crisis. But short of doing that, nothing is going to appease these people. You can't have an appeasement policy.
And you're not promoting surrender, and I don't hear anybody, but what is it? What's your end game? How do you address the possibility of a whole region just in flames against the U.S.?
Well, if you're not going to surrender, you'd better plan to win.
And what does that
mean?
The first
stage of winning is in South Lebanon. The second, by the way, what I said about North Korea, which is we should never allow the North Koreans to launch an ICBM, was also said by Democratic Secretary of Defense Bill Perry.
Mm-hmm.
It was also said by Democrat Vice President and Ambassador to Japan Walter Mondale, because they understand that the amount of damage that could potentially be catastrophically done to either Japan or the U.S. would be so horrendous.
You're saying when the missile's on the launch pad, take it out. It doesn't get to fire.
It never gets to be fired, not unless they accept U.S. inspection of the payload.
But hold that thought. Take us on to your end game in the Middle East. How does it play out?
You want to replace the Syrian and Iraqi and Iranian regimes? You'd like to replace them peacefully?
Ronald Reagan, if necessary. I mean,
Ronald Reagan had a strategy in defeating the Soviet Empire, and between 1981 and 1989, that strategy brought about freeing Poland, East Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. By 91, it also got in Ukraine.
There was a lot of talk with Gorbachev in the middle of all that. Where's the talk with Gorbachev here?
If we can find a Gorbachev, we should talk with him. Gorbachev didn't get up and say, I want to defeat the Americans and eliminate Israel from the face of the earth.
Newt Gingrich, we've got a lot of listeners who want to talk with you. I want to begin to turn to them, if I may. David's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
All right, well, I think we're fighting an impromptu war proxy, except that instead of fighting communists, we're fighting terrorists, and the main difference there, instead of fighting atheists, we're fighting religious fundamentalists. I mean, this is not something that can be won, you know? And we're basing a lot of what we do off the Truman Doctrine, and we should just totally throw that out. Altogether.
It can't be won. I mean, we have to address the reality of the world somehow. Newt Gingrich says, be tough, and go after it. What are you suggesting?
We're not going to win. You know, you're right. World War III is happening, except it just hasn't been declared yet.
What, you're just giving up? You don't have any path that looks like a winner to you?
I don't know. Just straight diplomacy, you know? Don't forget war.
David, thanks for your call. Newt Gingrich, how do you go after this without alienating a whole region? I mean, and what do you take away from the experience in Iraq? We went in there. It looks like a mess right now. I don't know what you make of it, but is that the template?
Look, it is a mess right now. I mean, I'm not, as I said a while ago, this is not going to be easy, but let me point out to our caller. Trotsky once said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. If I thought that we could find a way to not have to fight these people, I would be for not fighting them. But if you look at what Israel tried to do, they gave up land for peace in South Lebanon 6 years ago. And this isn't a sudden impromptu war. For 6 years, Hezbollah has armed, prepared, trained, and Hezbollah went into Israeli territory. The soldiers they kidnapped were on clearly defined Israeli territory. No one doubts that. So they deliberately invade Israel to steal these soldiers to start this fight.
But please speak concretely to what you see going forward, because Americans are looking at Iraq now. They've seen the losses there. They've seen the chaos there, the bloodshed, the talk of civil war. If that's the template, I can imagine a lot of people saying, boy, we don't need that times 10. Is that what Newt's proposing?
I'm not proposing anything. I would love to have a peaceful world. I'd love to have neighbors that were like Canada.
You're talking war top to bottom as far as I can hear.
Well, I am saying if the North Koreans are developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles with the Iranians there as their customers and their allies, if the Iranians have for some 27 years been developing Hezbollah as a weapon to kill us with, if the Syrians are the active allies of the Iranians, if there is a plot to destroy tunnels in New York City, if there's a plot to kill the Canadian prime minister.
So are you saying regime change in Syria and Iran by war if necessary?
No. What I said was we should do everything we can to achieve it peacefully. Ronald Reagan did not go to war to eliminate the Soviet Empire, but he knew every morning he was in the business of defeating the Soviet Empire.
But Jack Beatty laid out I'm sure he would describe as a peaceful path to achieving this. And you say, no way.
Well, no, he described a permissive path in which the dictators have to give you permission. I mean, what he described was he was going to call Assad and say, why don't you be nice to us? Let's create a grand bargain.
So you say it has to have the threat of war in it. It must have. The threat of war must
be. He didn't say that. No. He said.
No, you're saying not permissive, but rather threat of war to make it tough.
I'm saying, that's exactly what I'm saying. All of our experience with Iran and with Syria for a quarter century would indicate that you cannot have a permissive approach because it won't happen.
Let me go to Saeed in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Saeed. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom, I don't want to take your time.
Please do.
With respect to a history teacher, former Speaker of the House, I'm from Iran. He has a wrong concept of the Middle East. First of all, the new president of Iran is not a madman. He has no choice to speak like that because he just came back from Iran. The Middle East problem, nobody in America wants to acknowledge. Prior to 1930, there was no country. It was a great Palestine. If someone in America stands up and says there was no Lebanon, no Syria, no Saudi Arabia, no Kuwait, no Iraq, no Lebanon, and why we are going after supporting only Israel when there was none of these governments existed, if someone answered that, you solve the Middle East problem peacefully, as the former Speaker of House wished that. The problem is we don't want to acknowledge that. When you guys were supporting IRA, the IRA was coming up to this country between 1970 to 1990, collecting money and going and blowing up the British. Not a single person in this country raised a voice and says, hey, this is something wrong. I can show you 100 locations in this country that IRA openly collecting money.
Are you saying, Saeed, that Ahmadinejad did not say, I want to defeat the Anglo-Saxons and eliminate Israel from the face of the earth?
With all due respect, if you have a president in this country that is telling another ruler of another country, you have 48 hours to leave your country or I will invade your country. Is that the logic of a president of the United States that says to another country...
You're talking about Saddam Hussein?
Right, that's what I'm saying at you. So you made the whole world chaos when the most powerful leader of the world, standing in the White House at the front of the TV, telling the whole world, you have 48 hours to leave your country. The question in the Middle East is this. Who is this guy? How can he come to our area and make rules? I'm a U.S. citizen. I voted for him. I was shocked when he said that. We're not in a cowboy's world. Former Speaker of the House forgetting that the Reagan administration made a deal with the Iranian government in 1980 to swing the election toward Ronald Reagan. He forgets about the history. If you want to talk about
that's not true.
History after history, that's not true.
That's not
true. There was an investigation in the front line that proved that the parties were involved in that swinging the election from Carter to Reagan.
Saeed, we've got the perspective loud and clear, and I want to get one more caller here from Madison, Wisconsin. Bikas is on the line. Hi, Bikas, you're on the air with Newt Gingrich.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Hello, Mr. Gingrich. It's an honor.
Hello.
Tom, I find Mr. Gingrich's claim that we did not pick this war to be rather glib, because we might not have picked up this war explicitly to begin with, but we did pick it up implicitly through many of our policies.
Which war? What do you mean? The whole kit and caboodle Iraq?
The whole war on terrorism or the entire perspective from the global perspective that Mr. Gingrich just gave, including... different theaters in India and different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these conflicts are a direct result of the legacy of colonization of this region for many years by Western powers. And to take the context of India here, I don't know why nobody ever mentions that, and Mr. Gingrich never does, that a lot of these jihadis who operate in India right now are a direct result of the U.S. turning a blind eye to the regime of Ziaul Haq during the 80s when Mr. Reagan wanted support of Pakistan to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan.
Right, there's history there as well because we've got it. Newt Gingrich, here two callers in a row saying, hey, you know, history's more complicated than you're presenting it, Speaker Gingrich. What do you say?
Well, let me just say that the United States did not go out and invent al-Qaeda taking down the World Trade Center, having an airplane hit the Pentagon, having a fourth airplane land, crash killing the American passengers in Pennsylvania. The United States did not invent the Iranians killing American airmen at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. The United States did not invent the USS Cole being hit by terrorists in Lebanon. The United States did not in Yemen. The United States did not invent 280 Marines being killed by Iranians and Hezbollah in Lebanon in 1983. And the United States did not invent two American embassies being destroyed in East Africa by terrorists. And so it strikes me that it's one thing to say we have arguments that come out of historic past. Mm. It's another thing to say that the Iranians and their allies get to kill as many people as they want to because, after all, sometime in the past somebody did something bad. The one caller was describing a world in which the Ottoman Turks ran the region. I suspect he would not favor returning all of that region back to Turkey.
Newt Gingrich, there's a lot of talk about you and a run for the White House. I want to look at presidential power for a moment, if we may, with a piece of tape here. On Tuesday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, said President Bush personally blocked an ethics investigation by Justice Department officials into his administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Disclosure made after the Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, pressed Gonzalez to explain why the department's investigators from the Office of Professional Responsibility, OPR, were denied security clearance to look at the program. Here's a bit of that exchange, beginning with Senator Specter.
Did the president make the decision not to clear OPR?
As with all decisions that are non-operational in terms of who has access to the program, the president of the United States makes the decision.
Newt Gingrich, presidential power. Arlen Specter raising the big question there, and the AG saying, look, it was the president's decision to keep this door closed. Was it the right decision?
No. It was clearly the wrong decision. I think, first of all, that the Congress has an explicit oversight role and an explicit role of authorizing legal activities and financing legal activities. And the president has an obligation to brief the Congress, and he has an obligation to inform the Congress, or the Congress has every opportunity to simply not fund things. I mean, the constitutional balance is quite clear and is quite deliberate.
People are talking about you for the presidency. Do you see that balance as broken right now, or is it out of whack?
No, it's bent a little bit. It's not broken, but it's bent. And I think, and I've been pretty clear publicly, I think the Congress should do more oversight, and I think that the Congress should, I thought the recent Supreme Court decision was quite clear that the president should go to the Congress to get the right rules of engagement for dealing with people who want to kill us and who are terrorists. And I think that's exactly right. There's a profound positive effect of having the Congress on behalf of the American people have to publicly debate core issues and publicly establish key principles. And I think it's always a mistake for presidencies to try to operate in secrecy when you're talking about institutional principles. I think operational activities can be secret within the grounds of briefing the key members of Congress. And when I was Speaker, I was one of the group of eight who were routinely briefed on things. And I think as long as those are people are briefed, then the balance is appropriate. But I think for the executive branch to wander off doing a lot of things on its own without any participation by the legislative branch is inevitably in the long run a mistake.
Why do you think it's happened in the past several years of the Bush administration then, the bending of the balance, your word? Why?
I think that there's some people in the administration who are overreacting to the mid-1970s and who think that the post-Watergate, post-Vietnam cycle, the too much power and the weakness of the Jimmy Carter presidency, the too much power was shifted back to the legislative branch. So there's sort of this has been a 225-year shoving contest. I mean,
you're talking Cheney and Rumsfeld. Do you see the GOP, a GOP-led Congress shoving back at some point?
I think they've started to. That was a Republican chairman you just had on the air.
He's been a voice in the wilderness very often, or sounded that way.
Well, but they've also won some key votes now, and I think it's fair to to say that Senator Lugar, who's a Republican, is pushing back. I think it's fair to say that the appropriators are pushing back. And I think that's healthy. I think our Constitution works best when there's tension between the three branches.
Jack Beatty, we've heard Newt Gingrich on his view of what's going on in the world. He wants a very, bold, let's say, U.S. posture there. Do you see that as compatible with the constitutional balance? Or do you think a president has to pick up extra power to go down a kind of let's-go-for-it path like that?
I don't, but that's the trouble with war, and especially the trouble with an open-ended war, that we might change. And I think we have considerably under this administration. They have breached boundaries that haven't been breached before vis-a-vis the separation of powers. You know, this question to Gonzalez wasn't about the Congress. It was about a Justice Department investigation, ethics investigation. Mm-hmm. And a senior Justice Department official was quoted saying, "This refusal, the president's refusal to grant the clearances for this ethics investigation was unprecedented." And he said that it was probably, he thinks it might have been denied because investigators, quote, might find misconduct by those who were attempting to defeat the probe from being conducted, end quote. In other words, a cover-up. The president seems to have ordered a cover-up. Now, that's a pretty, you know, leave out separation of powers. This is just a matter of the professional work inside the Justice Department. He would not let that work go forward. Why?
Cover-up suggests illegality. Newt Gingrich, are we approaching that that proper description of what's going on?
Well, first of all, in every significant war the United States has been involved in, including Democrats Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Harry Truman, including Republican Abraham Lincoln, there have always been aggressive actions by the executive branch. Nothing has happened in our period comparable to Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare in 1919, which arrested thousands of Americans. That was a liberal Democrat, by the way. Nothing has happened comparable to Franklin Delano Roosevelt moving thousands and thousands of Japanese Americans from their homes and putting them in camps. That was a Democrat, by the way. So let's just start with the notion this president has in some areas expanded executive power. I think some of it is unwise. I think it is always wrong for a president to not have somebody keeping an eye on ethics and legality, because in a big, complex government, you inevitably have some people do things that are bad. And you want to have systems of oversight, and you want to have systems of surfacing those things, and you want to ensure that you obey the law. So, you know, I can't tell you why the president has done these things. I can tell you that I think that it would be better for the country and better for him if he had a more orderly procedure of supervision and of outside inspection.
Mm. We're talking with Newt Gingrich. Aaron's calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for former Speaker Gingrich regarding the House of Representatives and having fought for, you know, 40, well, not you personally, but being 40 years in the wilderness there. What do you think of incumbent gerrymandering? And ought we not to try and adopt an Iowa model? If your suggestion is that's for the people of the states to decide, wouldn't you encourage people in Georgia and elsewhere to try and adopt that kind of model? I'm just concerned with 90% incumbent plus 90% retention rates and all that. And doesn't that start to really, you know, I've never met a challenger who wrote a law. Isn't there some kind of an incumbent protection racket going on here?
Newt Gingrich, 90% incumbency and redistricting, how do you see it?
Well, first of all, there was a very high level of incumbent reelection until 1994 when we picked up 53 seats, and that changed the percentages for a while. Second, in Winning the Future, I outlined, we added a chapter on congressional reform because I do believe that we ought to come closer to the Iowa model of redistricting. I think that it, you know, districts ought to ultimately be designed for the American people, not for the incumbents. I also think that in a district, you should be allowed to give unlimited amounts. If you're a voter in that district, there should be no restriction on the amount you want to give, because that would allow challengers to raise money adequate to offset all the various incumbency tax-paid advantages. And I think that it would be healthy to have more competition. I've also proposed that we abolish all fundraising in the Washington metropolitan area with PACs for all incumbents, to take away the degree to which they raise Washington money to buy their seat on behalf of Washington.
On the House front, earlier this year, you said, as all the scandals were breaking, and there's more to come on that front, we're told, that it would be another scandal if the GOP didn't respond to Abramoff and all the rest of it with thoroughgoing reform. So have Republicans in the House and Congress now risen to the scandal we've seen there?
No. And I'm very disappointed. And I think that it's a mistake. I think that the not just for Republicans, but for Democrats. I mean, you know, Jefferson, the congressman who had $90,000 in his refrigerator, is a Democrat. The ranking Democrat on the Ethics Committee had to step down when it turned out he and some friends had a sweetheart deal involving appropriated funds. I mean, both parties have significant problems, and I think that they need to recognize that these are problems that require real reform. And
your party's had power for a dozen years. It looks like it's gotten worse.
No, I don't. I think that we are not in the kind of shape the Democrats were in at the end of their 40-year reign. But it is too bad for the party of reform. Republicans only make sense as the party of taxpayers who want reform of Washington. They don't want pork from Washington. And for the Republicans, it's particularly dangerous not to be the reform party.
Then look at the politics of this with us for a moment. I mean, even you are willing to say they haven't stepped up to it. What do the midterm elections look like to you coming up? And how do you see the presidential race beginning to shape up?
Well, those are two radically different questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, I think the campaign for the next 90 days may be one of the most interesting in modern American history because the country is not happy with Republicans. All the polling data shows that. On the other hand, every time the country starts to look at the Democrats, they are so far to the left. The spirit of Nancy Pelosi and the politics of San Francisco so define the Democratic Party right now. If you look at their vote patterns, even voting, 153 of them voted against protecting the Pledge of Allegiance and the right to say one nation under God in a vote this week. And you look at these kind of fairly left-wing votes, I think it's very hard for the Democrats to make the kind of gains they could potentially because they can't reach out and appeal to most Americans when they're that far to the left. So I think it'll be a very interesting campaign this fall to see which party gets its message across more effectively. I also think the Republicans have to keep changing. They've got to recognize that the signals they're getting from back home are genuine signals of a desire for change. I would point out that in the only special election we had this spring, all the pundits said the election really mattered, and they were all, I think, counting on the Democrats winning, and they were then going to say, boy, this indicates they're going to win this fall. And there was a deafening silence the day after Brian Bilbray, running as a 1994 Contract with America reform Republican, won the seat, and the Democrat got precisely the same percent as John Kerry. And if that happens around the country, then, in fact, it'll be a very disappointing election for liberals.
And on the other hand, Ralph Reed, tarred by the Abramoff business, loses a primary in Georgia, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I've said publicly that was a sign voters wanted reform. And the fact is that Senator Cagle, who won that primary, is almost certainly going to be the next lieutenant governor of Georgia. And you're likely to have Georgia continue to drift towards being more Republican. I'll also tell you, as a prediction, I think Ken Blackwell is going to win the governorship of Ohio. And I think it's going to be a stunning upset and people are going to be shocked by it. But Ted Strickland has voted with Nancy Pelosi and San Francisco values, and Ohio's not a state where left-wing values are very successful statewide.
And 08, presidential politics, and your place in it, Newt Gingrich?
Well, we're going to have some very strong candidates. I think you have to look at Senator McCain, who has a lifetime of service both in the military and in Congress. You have to look at Rudy Giuliani, whose book, Leadership, I regularly urge people to read. He's a terrific leader. You have to look at Mitt Romney, who's done a great job both with the Winter Olympics and now as governor, and who has one of the most interesting programs in health care in the country. And you got to look at George Allen, who's been a congressman, a governor, and a senator, and who's a very solid conservative. My job is to do what we're doing today. I want to talk about what does America need to do today? Not what would I do in 2009, but what does America need to do now?
Are you going to run for the White House,
sir? Successful country.
Will you run for the White House?
I have no plans at the present time to run, but I'm not ruling it out, and you can't tell what late next year may look like.
John's calling from Laurinburg, North Carolina. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah.
My comments are basically related to some of the things that we said before about Jimmy Carter being a weak president. And I think that a lot of the things that we're getting into in the Middle East today are from lack of understanding and lack of compromise. I realize that Israel is a problem that just isn't going to go away. But in a way, many of the people in the Middle East are fighting against our culture because of some of the negatives that they see in it. And I wonder how Mr. Gingrich would approach compromise with the Middle Eastern leaders, because it seems to me that the one issue that pulls them together is their faith.
Faith, you're talking about, I mean, that's widely seen as dividing. You're saying faith could be something to pull the region together?
Their faith is pulling them together, I believe. I think that, you know, they don't see America as a democracy and a capitalist country with great hope for them. They see it as having many negative values. And so, I wonder if we're, as a country, realizing that and taking steps to try and correct things. For example, Jimmy Carter said at the time of the incident in 1979 that we needed new energy sources. But we're going after oil, and they see us coming in and invading a country for no apparent reason and being very aggressive.
Newt Gingrich, is there a way to put a face on America and an American interest that would be more appealing and reach some outcome through compromise here?
Let me take up two parts of what the caller just said. First of all, Jimmy Carter toasted the Shah of Iran on New Year's Eve and before the end of the year had totally abandoned him, sending a signal of weakness to the region. Jimmy Carter did nothing to encourage the Ayatollah's forces to seize the American embassy. It was a deliberate, unprovoked assault on the United States by people who described us as the Great Satan. Now, I just want to suggest to our listeners, Great Satan is not a positive term. People who think you're the Great Satan think they should kill you. Second, the gentleman's exactly right. I think if we're prepared to deny women the right to vote, to deny them the right to work, to deny them the right to be in meetings with men, if we're prepared to say that they should stay at home and hide their faces, I think we can create an America that the Taliban and al-Qaeda would be comfortable in. What? But it strikes me that that's inconceivable. That's the whole point. Iran is a country which currently executes homosexuals, doesn't repress them, doesn't deny them the right to get married, kills them. Now, at what point do we say that's probably not a country we're going to appease?
A last question.
That's not a value system.
We've just got a minute. What lesson, then, do you take from what's happened in Iraq?
I think we made some mistakes in Iraq. I think in the end we will win in Iraq. I think that we are winning in Afghanistan. And I think that, sadly, unfortunately, we have no choice except to win because these people that we are currently faced with, from North Korea to Iran to Syria, to al-Qaeda, to Hamas, to Hezbollah, have a value structure which makes it impossible to compromise with them unless we're prepared to give up virtually everything we think of as American liberty. And so I think, sadly, we simply need to calmly and methodically follow Ronald Reagan, design a grand strategy, have as much of it as possible be political, economic, diplomatic, and information campaigns, as little of it as possible military, but understand it is a worldwide campaign, and these people are our enemies. They're not confused. They are our enemies.
Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, author of Winning the Future, A 21st Century Contract with America, now out in paperback. All the wise guys say he's running for president. You've heard him say, don't know yet. Newt Gingrich, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, last word goes to you, my friend.
Well, the speaker's world is almost a little more frightening than our world, the real world. It may be the one that's there, but boy, it's a scary prospect.
Newt Gingrich. Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.